The topic for tonight is, how did Hanukkah survive? And it's a question that we have to ask, because Hanukkah is a holiday that celebrates a victory of a certain group of people, the Hasmoneans, who take power for themselves over the land of Israel, and eventually are ousted by their successors, who are the Herodians, who viciously kill the Hasmoneans. Also, the holiday celebrates the rededication of a temple, which eventually is burned down by a guy named Titus. So the various reasons to observe this festival arguably disappear at some point in time, whether a century or two centuries later. So you might ask, well, then how does this holiday, which is a non-biblical holiday, if it were a biblical holiday, understand, the law of the Torah is the law of the Torah, it must be preserved, the door of Ador, from generation to generation. But a post-biblical holiday whose reason has come and gone arguably should die a natural death, and yet we're here observing the holiday. So how did it survive? Now this question is one that could easily be overlooked, except for the fact that there's something missing in the oral law. And what is that? There's no tractate of Hanukkah in the Mishnah. In the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, there is no Masechet Hanukkah. Okay, so what is there in the Mishnah? There is a tractate for Shabbos, there's a tractate for Pesach, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, Purim, Sukkot. Okay. More than once, we'll get to them, but there's no tractate of Hanukkah, which led the classical commentators and the more recent commentators and the academic historians to offer their various theories as to why there is no tractate on Hanukkah. And from these various answers that we have on the page here, we'll then move into, well, what really did happen to Hanukkah? Did it survive, or maybe it temporarily went on hiatus? Okay? Yeah. So
Sinatra had a song, Whatever Happened to Christmas?
All right, well, we'll find out whatever happened to Hanukkah. So, yes, absolutely, absolutely, it did. A long one, a very long one.
400 years
ago. Yeah, okay, so the first answer that appears in the book, the Chut HaMishulash, which was written by the Shlomo Sofer, the grandson of the Chatam Sofer, was that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the redactor of the Mishnah, purposely left out mention of Hanukkah because of a petty complaint he had against the Hasmoneans, that his family is the Davidic dynasty. The patriarchal family is claiming Davidic ancestry, and so they are the rightful kings of Israel. And yet the Hasmoneans, who were priests, arrogated for themselves the kingship as well, which was an unlawful thing or an inappropriate thing in the eyes of many. And so in order to stick it to them for having done something wrong and usurped the prerogatives of the Davidic family, he ousted them from the Mishnah. That's a classic answer by the grandson of the Chatam Sofer, claiming that his grandfather espoused that view. Now, that's not such a pleasant thing to believe in, because it means that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was tampering with sort of the authenticity of the oral law because of a family gripe against another family in Israel. And so the Mahariat, the second source on the page, says that that's not what the Chatam Sofer meant. That rather, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi deleted any reference to Hanukkah or a tractate about Hanukkah, not because he had a complaint against the Hasmoneans because of a family issue, but rather because he wanted to protect their honor, that they had done glorious things for Am Yisrael by fighting the Greeks and liberating the temple, and only later went sour. So in order to not embarrass them, let's just leave them out, and you'll only know about them from the story of Hanukkah, the good part of their history. This is also not a very compelling answer. I don't like it at all. Now, the third source on the page is the Tzitz Eliezer, which quotes the Chidah. And this answer is that there was no need for a tractate in the Mishnah about Hanukkah, because the laws of Hanukkah already appear in Megillat Ta'anit. Now, what is Megillat Ta'anit? Many times we've discussed this in the past. What is Megillat Ta'anit? It's the scroll of fasts. Now, the scroll of fasts is a misnomer. It's not a scroll of actual fasts. It's a scroll of days in which you're not allowed to fast. These are half holidays, happy occasions, when our people either defeated the heathens or the good Jews defeated the bad Jews. You know, the sectarians were ousted from power. And so on these days, in Second Temple and maybe post-Second Temple times, if it was a half holiday, you couldn't fast, and you couldn't give a eulogy on some of them. So Hanukkah falls into this category. The rededication of the temple was a victory of ours over the heathens. And so in the scroll of fasts, the Megillat Tanit, we have on Hanukkah, 25th of Kislev, begins an 8-day festival called Hanukkah. So since this material, which is older than the Mishnah, Megillat Tanit is older than the Mishnah, it was unnecessary for another work called the Mishnah to recapitulate the same things.
Right. Is Purim in the Book of Tanis?
Yes.
So it seems to be Purim, as in the Bible, gets a whole hell of a lot of more press.
Yes.
So you're saying, oh, we're mentioning Hanukkah in this little book. So we're not going to go ahead. We're not going to take the book.
It's not a very good answer. Okay. Let's go to the fourth answer. The fourth answer actually...
Purim had a book in the Bible.
And Purim is a book in the Bible, right.
That's the same thing. Yeah. The book of the Maccabees was not allowed to be in the Bible.
And we're going to see, not just that it wasn't in the Bible, it disappeared completely. Okay, so the fourth answer is the Yad Ne'eman, which I happen to like this answer to an extent. He says that there are many important day-to-day mitzvot that are not... do not have tractates of the Mishnah, because it was unnecessary. They were halachot yiduot. What are halachot yiduot?
Well-known
things. So, for example, tzitzis, tefillin, mezuzah. Where's the tractate in the Mishnah about those important day-to-day topics? They don't exist. Yes, the Mishnah in passing will refer to some of these things in various tractates, in Menachos and in Brachos, but there's no tractate for these basic day-to-day mitzvot. Why not? The argument is, everybody knew how to do that stuff. There was no need for a sophisticated treatise in the oral law to give you the details. Okay, all right, maybe it's a good answer, maybe it isn't. And the argument is that Hanukkah happens every year. It's a simple thing. You light the candle, you strike the match, you put the fire to the candle, and we're in business. All right. Answer number five is in the writings of the Chatam Sofer, in which he says that sometimes laws or a body of law will appear in the Mishnah, even if not in its own tractate, because the nature of the Mishnah is to mention things in passing. That's true. If anyone who studied the Talmud is aware of the fact that you go from topic to topic in a given tractate, sometimes having nothing to do with the broader theme of the tractate. But still, if we wanted to know why there was no tractate whatsoever about Hanukkah, this is not a very impressive answer. So let's go to answer number six, which is something that I've mentioned in the past. It's from the book Yesod HaMishnah V'Arichata by Reuven Margoliot, who was a traditional commentator, but with a certain critical lens. And he explains that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi intentionally left out a tractate about Hanukkah and avoided mentioning Hanukkah in the other tractates, to the extent that he could avoid it, because he wanted to not upset the delicate balance with Rome. That the relationship between Judaism and Rome, or the Jewish people of Eretz Israel and Rome, was very poor in the year 70, the year of the destruction. It was again very poor in the years of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, and in the years of the Hadrianic persecution in the 130s. But by the late 2nd century, the relationship with Rome improved, and Rebbe had a good working friendship with the Caesar. So what would he do then to avoid antagonizing the Caesar? So you try to downplay nationalistic observances, whether they be happy ones or sad ones. Now, famously, the Gemara in Megillah says that Rebbe downplayed the 17th of Tammuz, Purim, and the 9th of Av. He tried to abolish the 9th of Av. So certain fast days were downplayed. Purim, as a celebration of the defeat of the anti-Semitic Persians, was downplayed. And what about Hanukkah? It doesn't mention anything about Hanukkah, but maybe Hanukkah too is objectionable because it's too much of a chauvinistic Jewish holiday about our victory over the heathens. So what does Rebbe do? He leaves it out of the Mishnah. Don't offend the Goyim. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It certainly casts him in a very different light in terms of the completeness of everything else that he compiled.
Right.
As an editor.
Okay. You're right. But then again, the whole Tannaitic corpus that is beyond the Mishnah, the Braita and the Tosefta, is evidence of the fact that he was selective in what went in and what didn't go in. Yeah.
You also had, over history, a lot of censorship. going on, either through Gemara or through Tefillah and everything else, it could have been censored later on.
I don't think so. There's absolutely no evidence that that happened, and I don't know of anything, any situation where a whole block of knowledge was cut out to appease some, you know, some censor. Specific lines that are objectionable because of theological reasons, or they're just, you know, patently offensive to some particular king or queen, that could get excised, but not a whole book. Yeah. Yes, so we're going to get to that very, very soon. It's on the page. Yeah.
Number two, in the Sefer HaMakabim, that was not part of the Soret, so to speak.
No, and that's also I'm going to talk about in about 1 minute.
Wasn't Pompey from Rome invited because there was strife?
Between Hyrcanus and Aristobulus in the year 63, and he walked on in and took over the joint.
Right, so I can't see why that would be a sore point for the Romans in 70 AD if they were called in when there was this situation and they were the quote-unquote heroes.
Because even though the Romans actually were allies of Judah Maccabee in the Hanukkah story, still the very notion of Jews who are a feisty bunch and who have rebelled multiple times celebrating another one of their earlier rebellions cannot be good. Okay. So in the 20th century, Louis Ginzburg, the great Talmudist from JTS, came up with a theory. He noticed that not only is there no Mishnah about Hanukkah, but that even the material in the Talmud that we have about Hanukkah is almost exclusively in the Babylonian Talmud. And from the absence of Eretz Yisrael materials about Hanukkah, he came to the conclusion that Hanukkah was not observed in the land of Israel between the year 70 and when it was resurrected sometime in the late 3rd century, by whom we'll see in about 10-15 minutes. So he initiates this theory that for 2 centuries there was no Hanukkah or not much of Hanukkah in Eretz Yisrael. Louis Ginzburg. Okay. So now those who read his materials thought that what Ginzburg meant was that the rabbis had an unfavorable view of the Chashmonaim, and there are 4 reasons. Why you might think or claim that the rabbis had an unfavorable view of the Chashmonaim. One is the absence of a Mishnah, or for that matter, Eretz Yisrael material altogether in the Talmud. Number 2 is the fact that the Book of Maccabees was written in what language?
Greek.
Wrong. No. It was written in Hebrew. We have it in Greek. What happened to the Hebrew? It was lost. How do you lose a book? Answer, it isn't important. But why wouldn't it be important? You have the holiday of Hanukkah. The answer, there was no Hanukkah. Okay, you get the point? If Hanukkah was important, then the Book of Maccabim in Hebrew would not have been lost. It would have been treasured and possessed by our people in large quantity of copies.
Translated into Greek, yeah?
Translated into Greek, yeah.
And then was retranslated back into Hebrew.
Much later, 1,800 years later, in modern times. Yeah.
And how did that, do we have any idea if that's a faithful rendition of it compared to...
We can't know. We simply cannot know.
No, but it never made the canon. In those days,
granted that it never made the canon, but there are plenty of other things that we have from the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha that we have in the original Hebrew. And so why not Maccabees? The argument is, it wasn't important because in the Holy Land, they weren't doing this anymore. Now, two more things that would be evidence to say the rabbis were hostile to the Hasmoneans and therefore Hanukkah was suppressed. Another one is, my Hanukkah. What do you mean, my Hanukkah? What is Hanukkah? How do you not know what Hanukkah is? The answer, it was suppressed or for a long time was not observed. Therefore, people really didn't know. They didn't know what it was. And the 4th explanation is the miracle of the oil. The Ma'ay Hanukkah passage in the Gemara, which is source 8 on your page, goes into the miracle of the oil. The miracle of the oil is a very late addition to the legendary canon about Hanukkah. It appears in 2 places, in the Babylonian Talmud and the Megillat Ta'anit. But it's in the scholion of Megillat Ta'anit, not in the original text. It's a later addition. So, the miracle of the oil, putting aside whether it happened or it didn't happen, nobody knew it happened, if it did, until hundreds of years later. Okay, that's my nice way of saying what I think. All right.
So
now,
how was it observed?
Why was the miracle of the oil put forth? Answer, to give an alternative spin on a holiday that is being now brought back to life, where the original justification either is moot or politically problematic. So all these reasons put together led people to say, all right, there was no Hanukkah in the land of Israel for a while, and it's because the rabbis didn't like the Hasmoneans, because of whatever reason. Now, Gedaliah alone, who was the professor in Hebrew University in the first half of the 20th century, he did battle with Ginsburg and said, no, you're wrong. The good Zionist, he said that Jewish nationalism never died. And what? Hanukkah was observed all the way through. Don't tell me they stopped observing Hanukkah, you're wrong. They did all the way through. Okay. But the more recent scholarship says Ginsburg was basically right, but not for the reasons you think. It wasn't because the rabbis suppressed Hanukkah. It was rather because religion has to make sense. And if a holiday is recalling a dedication of a temple that no longer exists, that was burned down, then people are simply not going to observe it. It will not strike a chord emotionally with people, and simply they won't do it. Okay, so...
We say all the time, because that name is Shulchan Hashem Baruch Hamid.
That's a long-term goal for Am Yisrael throughout the years of the diaspora. But to recall a temporary victory that has been undone by, you know, overtaken by events, as they say in politics, Hanukkah has been overtaken by the events of 200 years later. Okay, understood. And that's a nice thing, so long as you haven't lost yet. Okay.
Well, now, didn't you once mention when we were talking about this that that Maccabee wanted to make it an 8-day holiday because it would be akin to a yontif, like
Sukkot.
Right. Yeah. Or something like that. So would that have any bearing on the religiosity of the observance over 400 years?
It will have bearing on the character of the holiday, that it will be a religious holiday as opposed to a secular holiday. But let's now look into the Mishnah itself. Because the Mishnah does, and the other Tanaitic literature, does talk about Hanukkah every so often in stray passages. And let's see if from these passages we can prove my working premise that for two centuries Hanukkah disappeared from the land of Israel. Not from the diaspora, but from the land of Israel. So, look in source number 9. And I haven't read anything inside yet, but I'll read this inside. Gamal shehayat un pishtan. A camel was laden with flax. V'yavar b'rshut harabim. And passed through the public thoroughfare. V'niknas pishtano l'tocha chanut. And the flax protruded into a storefront. And it knocked over a candle in the guy's store, and burned the house down. So who has to pay for the fact the house burned down? The owner of the camel and the flax, or the owner of the store whose candle it was? Who's liable? So Gemara says, Bal hagamal chayav, the camel owner is liable, because he shouldn't have allowed his flax to protrude into the store. However, if the candle was mibachutz, it was outside the storefront, then the owner of the store was liable because he shouldn't have put his candle in the public space. But Rabbi Yehuda Omer b'ner Chanukah patur, if it was Chanukah time, Rabbi Yehuda says the owner of the store is exempt. Why? Because it's socially acceptable on Chanukah to put your candelabrum in the public thoroughfare. Okay. Now, notice it doesn't say that the owner of the store was obligated to put his candle there. It just says that if he did it, we won't penalize him financially because what he did was within the bounds of acceptability in Jewish society. So it shows that Hanukkah was could be done, was recognized as something. But now let's go to the Tosefta, source 10. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Bener Hanukkah Patur, Bnei Sheiniach Birshut. In the case of the Hanukkah candle, the owner of the store is exempt from paying for the building that burned down because he placed it there with permission. With permission of whether the authorities or general Jewish society, that this is considered acceptable. You're allowed to do this.
Wait, but this is around 450 AD, right?
No. This is
the Gemara?
No, this is a Mishnah. This is a year 150.
Okay, isn't that beyond the gap that we're talking about?
It's in the donut hole. It's right in the time when I'm claiming that Hanukkah was not observed. So, the Mishnah said And the Tosefta said, Birshut, with permission. Now we go to the Yerushalmi that says, Baner Chanukah Patur, Bipnei Shehu Rishut. In the case of Chanukah, is exempt because it is a Rishut. What is the difference between Birishut and Rishut? Now, of course, the difference is there's a letter bet in the beginning. It's a preposition.
One is tacit.
Okay. So the word Rishut is in the hierarchy of religious observances on the bottom end of the ladder. The highest level is a chiyuv, an obligation, out-and-out obligation. Somewhere below that is a mitzvah, which might mean like a commandment, but here it means just a virtuous deed. And a rishut is even lower than that. It means it has some religious significance, but not much religious significance. Maybe optional, maybe quasi-obligatory, but it's on the low end of religious obligations. So the difference between rishut and birishut is that rishut means you must observe Chanukah. Birishut means if you observed Chanukah and the storefront burned down, you won't have to pay for it, but you didn't have to observe Chanukah. So what happened? I'm going to now read into this and say that the Mishnah was codified at a time when you didn't have to observe Chanukah, but some people did. Maybe a fringe phenomenon that was respected but not done universally, and that the Talmud is being codified at a time when it is an obligatory thing and everyone has to observe Chanukah. Now, how do I know that I'm right? Because the Bavli basically says so. Go to the next source. Birishut means you're allowed to do this, and if you did it, you haven't done anything wrong. So therefore, if the candle tips over and the house burns down, you won't pay for it because you didn't break any rules. But Rishut means you've done something religiously significant. You've done a virtuous deed. Okay. Now, the Gemara in the Bavli, source 12, says, my love, Rishut debating. What does Rishut mean? With the permission of the authorities, meaning you were allowed to do this. The Gemara says, no, lo, Rishut the mitzvah. No, it was a virtuous act. It was akin to a mitzvah. So the Babylonian Talmud, basically, if you read between the lines, says that the word Rishut underwent a metamorphosis. What originally meant an optional activity eventually came to be understood as an obligatory activity. That Hanukkah candles went from being something some people did because they felt like it, maybe a holdover from the temple era, to a later time when you must do it. Yeah. Well, we don't treat it as such anymore, but it was at a time. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah.
Okay. You say that started off small and lacked, excuse the pun, but a quarter on.
Yeah.
Later on, and that it was taken upon everybody, upon themselves.
Okay. Okay. So.
In other words, it caught fire.
It caught fire. All right. I would say that you're right, but. The premise is that in temple days, everyone was doing it as an outright obligation. So the fact that some point after the temple period, it was dumbed down to, well, some people are doing it, and then it caught on again, means that there is this period of intense Chanukah observance, later period of intense Chanukah observance, and some period in between where you don't have such intense observance. It's surviving, it's hanging on by a thread, but it's not totally obligatory.
Could you give me years?
Let's just assume between 70 and 270 is this donut hole. Okay, now let's go to another topic. Are you allowed to fast on Hanukkah? No, you're not allowed to. But some people did. So let's take a look. Source number 13. So, Ein gozrin ta'anit al hatzibur rosh chodesh b'chanukah uvapurim. You're not allowed to decree a public fast on the people on the half holidays of Hanukkah, Purim, rosh chodesh. Now, what kind of fast are we talking about here? Huh? No, public fast.
You mean like if there's a drought?
There's a drought, exactly. If there's a drought, if there are bears, if the enemy's at the gate, you know, if there is a locust, pestilence, whatever natural disaster or human-caused disaster leads the authorities of Judaism to declare a fast upon the community, so we have fast. Now, in the case of drought... Okay, all right. Now, when they have public fasts, what days of the week are they observed?
Market days.
Monday, Thursday, Monday. When there's no rain, there's a Monday, Thursday, Monday. There's another Monday, Thursday, Monday. And then there's a Monday, Thursday, Monday, Thursday, Monday, Thursday, Monday. So there's 3 + 3 + 7 for a total of 13 fasts if it doesn't rain. When are you supposed to have rain? Cheshvan. When is Hanukkah? Kislev. So right smack dab in the middle of these Bahabs is what? Chanukah. All right? We're expecting rain and it didn't happen. It's going to have fasts. Well, the Mishnah is saying you're not allowed to initiate a series of fasts on Chanukah. But what happens if you didn't initiate it on Chanukah? It was like the third Thursday or the fourth Monday or whatever it was. It was one of these days. You didn't intend for it to work out that way. It just works out that one of the Monday Thursdays happens to be on Chanukah. What do you do then? Do you observe the fast or do you not observe the fast? So Rabban Gamliel said, if it just works out that way, observe the fast. You wouldn't initially plan it that way, but if it happens, you fast. Okay.
What about yahrzeit?
Not on Chanukah. So, source 14.
If somebody passes away, their real yahrzeit happens to be Chanukah, you don't observe it?
No, you're talking about fasting on
a yahrzeit. So fasting on a yahrzeit, you do the yahrzeit, Kaddish and the like, but not fasting. So, Maaseh v'gazru tanis b'chanukah b'lulu. There was an incident. Number 14. There was an incident in which the authorities at the city of Lud declared a public fast on Chanukah. And Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua were not happy about it. Rabbi Eliezer took a haircut and Rabbi Yoshua took a bath. The act of taking a haircut or taking a bath on a fast day is indicative of what? Their objection to this being a fast. You're not allowed to take haircuts on Tisha B'Av or take a bath on Tisha B'Av. So, fasting. So they're saying this is wrong. What they're saying is Chanukah is a real holiday. Now, those who declared the fast were saying what? That Chanukah is not a real holiday anymore. Chanukah is finished. We're in a post-temple era. Chanukah is null and void. And the Eliezer and Yoshua say, no, Chanukah is still very much alive and well. So they're disputing the significance of the old holiday.
So what is Lieberman's role? Here's the second quote you have from Lieberman over here.
Uh-huh.
So what is Lieberman adding in this quote that's not in... Lieberman's contribution?
I don't think anything. I think this is just the version of the text in his edition. I don't think there's any emendations here. So what does Yoshua say? He says, you guys who declared the fast, you were wrong. And because you were wrong, you have to fast a makeup day to atone for having fasted on Chanukah.
Having not fasted on
Chanukah. No, for having fasted on Chanukah, you got to fast again to say you're sorry to Hashem for it. Okay. Now, so as long as Rabban Gamliel was alive, the law followed Gamliel, which was a middle ground position. After he died, Yoshua wanted the very lenient position vis-a-vis fasting, or the rigorous position vis-a-vis Hanukkah, to be the law, and Gamliel's heirs to his estate objected and said, no, you have to follow Rabban Gamliel even in his death. So what then happened? There were three opinions. There was the approach that says, let's fast on Hanukkah, because there is no such thing as Hanukkah. There's the viewpoint of Yoshua and Eliezer that there is a Chanukah and you can't fast. And then there's the middle ground, the sensible middle ground of investing, okay, of Rabban Gamliel, who said that you shouldn't declare a fast, but if it happens, go ahead and do it. Now what does he hold? Does he hold there is a Chanukah or there's no Chanukah? So it sounds like he holds that there is no Chanukah, but in deference to those who still preserve the old temple era holiday, he doesn't want to offend them, so therefore he would not initiate a series of fasts on a day that is sacred to some Jews, but if it turns out there is a series of fasts, we're not going to disrupt it. So basically he agrees with those who say Chanukah is null and void, but we have to respect the viewpoint of the minority that is still keeping the holiday. Okay. Now, the rest of the sources in the Mishnah and Tosefta can all be interpreted along those lines, as Chanukah not really being an official holiday on the books anymore, but one that some people were observing for old time's sake, and so in deference to those people, we will preserve certain of the old halachot, we'll keep them intact. For example...
When you say, in other words, on
Rosh
Chodesh, some people don't make a bracha,
the Sfarim. Yeah.
Wasn't such a big deal.
Okay. So that's the next source on the page. We're going to look right now. So source 15 is the list of the 6 months of the year when messengers would be sent out concerning the declaration of Rosh Chodesh. What months of the year do you need those messengers? Months where you have a holiday, where you need to know what day to observe the Chag. So one of those months was Kislev because of Hanukkah. In the post-temple era, they retained Kislev as one of those months in which the messengers were sent out. I would argue not because Hanukkah was fully obligatory, but because some people kept it up, including those in the diaspora. The Jews of the Galut maintained full observance of Hanukkah, so therefore they needed knowledge of Rosh Chodesh Kislev. But what about your point about Hallel? So, put aside the issue of the bracha. Jews in the post-Talmudic period are fanatically obsessive over the halachic minutia of the bracha, bracha levatala, bracha this, bracha that. If you read the Gemara, you'll never find it. Okay, yes, there's reference to the fact that there are certain brachot on the observance of mitzvot, but they don't worry about, do you make a bracha, do you not make a bracha? That's an acharonic obsession. It's not really in the Talmudic period. But the bigger issue is, what about the recitation of Hallel? So the Mishnah says, or the Tosefta says, on 18 days of the year, we say Hallel. What are those 18 days? The 8 days of Hanukkah, the 8 days of Sukkot, 1 day of Pesach, and 1 day of Shavuos. And in the diaspora, another 3 days. The second day Pesach, the second day Shavuos, and the 9th day of Sukkot. Okay, but if Hanukkah is not really obligatory anymore, why are we saying Hallel? And for that matter, go to Source 17 and 18. Source 17 is you have Al HaNisim in the Shmoneh Esrei, and Source 18 is that you have Laning. You have the Torah reading of the Nisim, Pashat Naso, on Hanukkah. So, answer is very simple. Liturgically, what have I said 1,000 times from this lectern? Once something gets encrusted into the liturgy, it doesn't come out. The prayer book only gets thicker, it doesn't get thinner. So even though a holiday might have only a marginal hold over the Jews of Eretz Yisrael, still, the liturgy will reflect that it was around. And for that matter, in the Chutz La'aretz, they're definitely observing it.
And the Chutz La'aretz had the majority of Jews.
By that time, probably yes.
Well, it was a stronger yeshiva than Yerushalayim.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But,
yeah.
I'm
glad somebody asked this question.
And then
okay.
Somebody in the diaspora be more attached to
okay, so I'm sure a few of you were thinking that, and Tina had the courage to ask it. Okay.
No, but especially in liturgy, if it's still in
liturgy, the question was this: why would it be that a holiday that is based out of Eretz Yisrael, about the temple, about fighting in the Holy Land, would be more preserved and intact in the Galut than in the land of Israel proper? It seems to be counterintuitive. So I will explain that before we finish tonight.
And yeah. If you look at Al HaNisim, the temple was not the only miracle. There were other miracles cited in the temple.
Well, in the Al HaNisim, it's mostly about the few and the versus the many, the wicked versus the hands of the righteous. Yeah. Okay, you're right.
To be able to, expand its importance outside.
And in the long run, all the homilists will do exactly that. All the Divrei Torah and Hanukkah talk about the wondrous Nisim and Niflaos, and they go beyond just the simple things.
Yeah. But how can you stand in Tefillah and say, the Kavush Man Yisrael, that the Nusach who stands in Tefillah, we will not keep it? I mean,
okay, so the answer to that is flip the page. Source 19. Go to Source 19 is your answer to your question. Yeah.
If in Israel you didn't have the temple anymore, why would you celebrate Hanukkah? And in Galus, you never had the temple, then you would have a reason for celebrating it because that was a victory that doesn't change the status quo as far as that.
Okay, so there you go. What you just said is the gist of the answer I'm going to give as we finish tonight. Okay, so the Yerushalmi Source 19 in Tanis talks about the big issue. What is the big issue? Batla Megillat Tanit, o lo Batla Megillat Tanit. Was the scroll of fast abrogated in its entirety, or was it not? Meaning, all these 35 special half holidays that used to be observed by Jews in the post-temple era, do they matter anymore, or do they not matter anymore? Now, you could interpret this passage in the Talmud, in the Yerushalmi, to mean, was there sort of a conclave of rabbis where they officially abrogated it, or was there not? But I don't think that's what they mean here. I think they mean, more generally, do the facts of history abrogate the scroll of fasts, or does it not? And most of the Amoraim held Batla Megillat Ta'anit, that the scroll of fasts was abrogated by the facts of history, that little holidays celebrating victories of yore don't matter when in the grand scheme of things we've been defeated as a people and are banished from our temple and holy places.
Is it the facts of history or what people didn't accept it as time went on?
That's one and the same. In other words, the popular will bends to the facts of history. Okay, so Rabbi Yochanan, and now we get to all of our answers. Now we're getting towards what we need to learn tonight. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Second line on source 19. Emesh hayti shone, ma'aseh shegazu tanit b'chanukah b'lud, v'emelav Rabbi Lezer v'shesipa v'yishu yet shurachat, v'emelahem Rabbi Yishu yitino mashitanitim, v'at amet batal migilat tanit. So Yochanan, the Amora, who lives in the 250s, 260s, 270s, is saying to his colleagues, you claim that the scroll of fasts is null and void? How could you possibly say such a thing? After all, the great Tanaim, Eliezer and Yehoshua, fought tooth and nail in the post-temple era to defend the integrity of Hanukkah. And you're going to tell me that scroll of fasts is null and void? You guys are wrong. I'm going to fall back upon the great heroes of the Tanaitic period and say, Hanukkah is still obligatory. And why is Hanukkah still obligatory? Because the whole scroll of fasts has not been abrogated. Right, that's his argument. But then one of his own disciples says, Amar Rabbi Abba, afilu tema batal megillat tanit, Chanukah prom labatal mileihon. You could say, you know what, the whole scroll of fasts is null and void, with two exceptions, Chanukah and Purim. Now, by the way, is this the halacha? Absolutely. Which is why everyone in the room knows Chanukah and knows Purim, and none of you ever heard of Yom Nicanor, Yom Tiryanus. Those have been forgotten, and only the antiquarians who read Josephus know about that. But the rest of you folks don't know that. Why? Because you don't need to know it, because it's gone and forgotten. But Chanukah and Purim, not gone and not forgotten. So then you have to ask, well, why? If we're going to abolish everything else as being irrelevant to our experience in the post-temple era, why hold on to Chanukah and Purim? Why? So the Bavli gives us an answer. Very, 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 very important answer. It's the most important thing you're going to learn tonight. Amar Rav Yosef, Shani Chanukah d'ika mitzvah. Chanukah is different because there's a commandment involved. In other words, you can get rid of an observance that is a purely negative observance. Meaning, on Yom Nicanor, I'm not allowed to fast. I'm not allowed to give a eulogy. But what affirmatively do I do? Nothing. Nothing. There's no ceremony. There's just some funerary things that I can't do. But from a positive, performative point of view, there's zero, zilch. Whereas on Chanukah, you have a ceremonial act, a religiously binding ceremonial act. What is that? Chanukah, lighting candles. And for that matter, on Purim, you have the Megillah reading, and you have the Mishalach Manos, and Suda, and Matanos Levyonim. You have ceremonies.
You also have a liturgical insertion.
A liturgical insertion, too. Yeah. Correct, correct.
So you may have the citation
Yeah, right.
But you don't have a special
Yalaviyavo. Okay, you're right. You know, okay, so you have Yalaviyavo, and you have Alanisim, and you have Chanukah candles.
But if you don't say Alanisim since it's Hodah, you don't have to repeat it.
That's true. All right, so it's not as important as some other things. No. The only Alanisim. So, but then the Gemara says like this. Amalei Abaye. Abaye says to Rav Yosef, Tibatel'i v'tibatel mitzvasa. If a holiday celebrates something that is irrelevant now, like the rededication of a temple that's been destroyed, it's forgotten, it's in the past. So abolish the holiday and abolish the ritual. Meaning, who cares if there was once a ritual? If the whole thing doesn't matter anymore, get rid of the ritual. It's a little chutzpah to say that. But, so what does Rav Yosef respond? Amar Rav Yosef, Shani Chanukah d'mefarsim nisa. Chanukah is different because the miracle has been aggrandized. Meaning, it's not just that there was any ceremony, stama ceremony, but rather that ceremony taught a valuable religious lesson, a spiritual lesson that is meaningful in every generation, not just in generations when the temple was around, but the notion of God's salvation, of miraculous divine intervention, is important no matter whether you live in the year 17 or 2017. And so it would be a shame for that to be lost in, you know, taking the scissors or the shears and chopping off chunks of Judaism. We don't want to do that. Therefore, Hanukkah should survive because it has a valuable mitzvah. It's a sellable. Yes, yes. Okay. Now,
sellable.
I think so. I think that it's meaningful religion that people can latch on to. Okay. Let's now turn to
the proof of the pudding here, yeah, is that even with the rise of the liberal elements in Judaism, the form and things like
they held on to Hanukkah.
They held on to Hanukkah and Purim.
Right.
It's not even an iota of alteration of religion.
Yeah. Okay, so let's now look at source 21. Rabbi Yochanan is now the man of the hour. Rabbi Yochanan is the one who defended the survival of Hanukkah, but he will also be one to innovate in the Hilchot Hanukkah, the laws of Hanukkah. But before we can get to his innovations, we have to examine what differences existed between Hanukkah as it was observed in the diaspora and as it was observed in Eretz Yisrael. In two important ways. One is the placement of the candles, and the other is the number of candles. When it comes to the placement of candles, the Babylonian Talmud says you put it petach hachatzer, at the entrance of the courtyard, which is pretty far away from your own house, because there are multiple houses in a given courtyard. Whereas in the Eretz Yisrael tradition, you put it mi petach beito, bachutz, outside your house, by the doorway to your house. Okay? What about the number of candles? So the Babylonian tradition was mitzvat Hanukkah ner ishu beito, one candle for each household. And if you want to be extra pious, v'mahadrin, ner l'kol echad v'echad, one for every member of your household. But what was the Land of Israel tradition? The Land of Israel tradition was either the school of Shammai or the school of Hillel. The school of Shammai was 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And the school of Hillel, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Either you go down as the days progress or you go up as the days progress. What's the reason for that? So the Hillelite reason is Malim B'Kodesh V'Moridim. We go up in holiness and we don't go down. What's the Shammai reason? He compares it to the Pre-Hachag, the bull offerings of the Musaf of Sukkot, which were 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7. So you go down as opposed to going up. From where do we know this? Well, it says so in the Talmud. But where does the Talmud know it? So the answer is Rabbi Yochanan learned it from two old fellows in Sidon. Look in source 27. Source 27, line 3 of that source. Amar Rabbi Baruchanan Rabbi Yochanan, Shnei Zekenim Hayu B'Tzidon, Echad Asak Kebeit Shammai, Echad Asak Kebeit Hillel. Zenatan Tamid Varav, Zenatan Tamid Varav. Each one gave the reason for their own actions. Where is Sidon?
Lebanon.
And where is Lebanon relative to Eretz Yisrael?
Lebanon.
And of all the countries in the diaspora, which is the closest country to Eretz Yisrael?
Lebanon.
Okay, so let's get to the heart of the matter. In the Land of Israel, as I am claiming here, Hanukkah candles were not widely observed in the Tanaitic period, or for that matter, even after that, from between 70 and 270. But in Babylonia, it was widely observed, but in a different way than had been done in Eretz Yisrael at an earlier time. So Rabbi Yochanan is trying to resurrect Hanukkah. Why? We'll see soon. But in trying to do so, he wants to preserve the old ways of Eretz Yisrael, which he might not even have known what they were. Or maybe he knew it was 8 down to 1 or 1 up to 8, but he didn't know why. And there was no one in Eretz Yisrael who knew the reasons for the 1 to 8 or the 8 to 1. Who knew it? Two oldsters in Sidon. Why Sidon of all places? Because Sidon is Chutz La'aretz, which means they're observing Hanukkah. But it's close enough to Eretz Yisrael that they would observe it in the style that was old-fashioned Eretz Yisrael style. So the only ones in the world who knew the reason for the old Israeli traditions were people who lived beyond the border, but just beyond the border, not too far away. And so from these anonymous figures in Sidon, we have no clue who they were. They might not have been great scholars. They were just reasonably learned Jews who preserved the old Eretz Yisrael traditions, and Rabbi Yochanan brought them back to life. Okay. What else did Rabbi Yochanan do? So, he initiated two laws of Hanukkah. Look in source 28.
Again, what year was Rabbi Yochanan?
The 250s, 260s, and 270s. Okay, so he dies in 279. Source 28. We're not going to read the whole thing inside, but the italics. Yochanan invented asur lihishtamesh la'ora. You are not allowed to use for personal benefit, for utilitarian purposes, the light of the Hanukkah candles. Now that's a staple of our observance of Hanukkah. Everybody knows that. It's in the Haneirus Halalu, number 28. Okay, it's in the Haneirus Halalu. Ein lanu rishus lihishtamesh b'hem al-rosim. We can only look at them. We can't make benefit from them. Are you allowed to benefit from the Shabbos candles? Yes, you're supposed to. That's the whole point of it. Shabbos candles are not a religious thing. For all the ladies of the house do with making brachas and waving their hands, the bottom line is Shabbos candles are not a religious thing. They're for social utility, so that you shouldn't stumble and trip over your neighbor, and you should be able to see your food. You shouldn't fall asleep in your soup. Shalom bayis, which is a very mundane thing. Okay, why do we make a bracha on Shabbos candles? Just to stick it to the Karaites who said you can't use fire on Shabbos. But Hanukkah candles are very different. Hanukkah candles are religious, Kodesh, holy. So that is the invention of Rabbi Yochanan. You look at them, you remember the miracles of the past, but you don't use them to count your coins or to look at your stamp collection. So that's the idea. He invents this notion of Asur Lishtamesh Bahem. Yes, absolutely. Right, yeah.
Otherwise,
okay.
You're supposed to fall down when you pass by the menorah.
The other thing that Rabbi Yochanan initiates is the timing of the lighting. When do we light candles? At night. When at night? So, in the beginning of the night, when people are still on the street, right? Well, so, Bizman Hazeh. So New York is a city that never sleeps because we have electricity. But before there was electricity, people shut down for the day. When it was dark out, you went to sleep at night. So the Hanukkah candles were in the beginning of the night when some people are still the stragglers in the road. This, in Hebrew, is Ad Shetichle Regel Min Hashuk, the bottom of Source 28. However, the Aramaic version of it is Amar Rabbi Yochanan, the last few words there, Adikalyo Riglu de Tarmodai, when the feet of the Tarmodai are gone from the marketplace. So who are the Tarmodai? If you look in the Rashi, so the Rashi says it's a shame Ummah, it's a group of people who used to collect, who were poor, and they used to collect wood after hours because they were so poor they couldn't afford to buy wood in the store, they'd collect the scraps that were left out in the field, the hefker.
Now, so
they were out beyond the ordinary person's work hours. If everybody went home and it got dark, at dusk, these folks were out another half hour, another hour. Rashi based himself on the Gaonim, who based themselves on basically flawed etymology. There's no evidence whatsoever that Tarmodai refers to wood, or for that matter, people who collect wood. We know what Tadmor means in rabbinic literature. What is Tadmor? Palmyra. Palmyra. Where is Palmyra?
Syria.
ISIS destroyed it a few years ago. Okay? So it's upstate New York too, right? The Mark Twain thing is there? Palmyra also is upstate, yeah. So Palmyra is Tadmor. If you want to play around with the word, and the rabbinic literature is unclear as to how you spell the word, is it Tarmodai, is it Tadmorai, or is it Tamrodai? If it's Tamrodai, so Taf Mem Resh, Tamar, Palmyra, P-A-L-M, Palm, Tamar, the date tree. Okay, so Alexander Kahut noted that similarity. Who are the Palmyrans?
So all these people are from JTS, Ginsburg.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I'm giving props to 3080 Broadway tonight.
Right.
Okay.
I just wanted to make that clear.
All right. So.
Those people were religious in those days.
And they were pretty smart, too. So, the Tarmodai were people who conquered Eretz Yisrael. The Palmyran Empire existed from the year 270 to the year 273. Now, what was going on? It was very short, but it was very important. The Roman Empire was in chaos in the 3rd century CE. It was very difficult for one man housed in Rome to control a geographically wide-ranging empire. So it was the tradition to have someone in the eastern provinces who would be like an underling who would report back to the boss in Rome. Later, there'd be a co-emperor of the east in the early Byzantine period. Okay, but this is a little bit before that. So you have someone who's watching over the provinces of the east. Who was that person? Odenathus, or Odinat in Hebrew. And Odenathus conquered portions of Babylonia and Asia Minor and northern Egypt and certainly Syria and Lebanon and land of Israel. In 267 he died, and he was succeeded by his widow, Zenobia, who ruled as a sort of a regent for her infant son, who wasn't yet ready to take the throne. So Zenobia is like the wicked queen, the wicked witch of the east. And why do the Jews not like Palmyra? Because the Palmyrans did two very vicious things to the Jews. One is they destroyed Naharda. What's Naharda? The big yeshiva of Naharda. Okay, it was one of the two leading Babylonian Jewish communities, together with Pumbedita. Okay, after the destruction of Naharda, things move further away to Zimachuza, to Matamachasya, and to Sura. But Naharda was a major center. Okay, and look in source 34. Source 34 says, "Uvishnat tafkuf ayin ata Papa Bar Netzer v'akavel Naharda." Papa Bar Netzer, which is the rabbinic literature's name for Odenathus, he destroyed Naharda. What year is tafkuf ayin? What number is that? Tuf is 400, Kuf is 100, Ayin is 70. So the year 570. What's the year 570? So the year 570 from the Seleucid calendar, which begins in the year 312 BCE. So 570 is the year 258, 259. In the year 259, we know as a historical matter, Naharda was destroyed, and many Jews died. A horrible tragedy for our people. Also, what happened? A year or two later, he invaded Eretz Yisrael, and many Jews died again. So the tradition has it that the Tadmorians, the Palmyrans, were involved in two calamities vis-a-vis Jews. Look at source 32. Source 32. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Again, Rabbi Yochanan plays an important role here. Ashrei mishu ro'eb matatasha Tadmor. Praiseworthy is he, lucky is he, who sees the downfall of the Tadmorians. Because they participated in the destruction of the first and the second temple. And did that really happen? No. Who destroyed the first temple? The Babylonians. And who destroyed the second temple? The Romans. So there's a little bit of a mistake here. It just means they were involved in two destructions. So if you look in source 33, it mentions Shtei Chorbanot, two general destructions, not of the temple, but of Jewish communities. One Babylonian community and the community of Eretz Yisrael. So we hate their guts. And we hate their guts so much that look in source 30. Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan said, "You're not allowed to accept converts from the Palmyrans." And that's already a big statement, because we are an open people. Right? The Jewish people, like, we accept proselytes from the whole world. Even from Amalek, you can accept a convert. But
Not Moab.
So Ammon and Moab cannot marry into the Kal Hashem. It doesn't mean they can't convert to Judaism. They can't marry into the main body of Israel.
They have to marry converts.
Correct. But when Rabbi Yochanan says, we don't even accept a convert from the Tadmori, what he's saying is, my ethnic hatred of them is so great that I'm going to say, you're out. None of you folks. Okay. Now, so we see Rabbi Yochanan is very much in the fray. Was he the only one who cared? Were the Jews active or passive in this general resistance to the Palmyrans? So usually the Jews are very passive, and we learn to accept our fate and not get involved in world politics. However, in this instance, the Jews were active, and it was a question of Rome or Palmyra. They both stink, but sometimes the lesser of two evils is the way you go. And Rome was the lesser of two evils. So the Jews actively were involved in a conspiracy to oust the Palmyrans and return the Romans. So let's look in source 31. I'm not going to read it all inside, I'll just paraphrase it. Rabbi Isi was caught up, was arrested in the conspiracy against the Palmyrans. Rabbi Yonatan said, it's a lost cause, he's going to die in captivity. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, no, it's not a lost cause, I'm going to risk my life to try to save him. And you know what? He saved him, and they brought Rabbi Isi to Rabbi Yochanan for a blessing, for a prayer. And Rabbi Yochanan said, everything that the Palmyrans wanted to do to you should happen to them. And what happened? They immediately all died. So a nice legendary tale about the bad guys got their comeuppance. But you see Yochanan is praying for the downfall of the Palmyrans. Then Zir ben Hananya was caught up in the conspiracy. He was arrested. Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Shmuel tried to appease Queen Zenobia to release the rabbi from captivity, and she said, isn't your God accustomed to performing miracles? Ask him for a miracle, but I'm not doing anything for you. And what happened? All of a sudden, someone came charging in and said, your husband was killed with this sword. And she fainted, and the Jews went free. Okay, so whether these stories happened or didn't happen, I don't care. What matters in this passage in the Talmud is that the Jews were politically active. Even the rabbis wanted the Palmyrans out and saw them as nasty, vindictive people who were hostile to our people and to our faith. And so we were even willing to have the Romans come back just to get those guys out. Now we can go back to the Gemara. It said, Adikaya Rugla Tamadai. So the halakha is still interpreted to mean you have to light candles while the people are still out in the marketplace collecting wood, the half hour after the stars come out. And maybe from a halakhic point of view, that's what was originally intended. But there was a double entendre. It wasn't just until the Talmudians leave for the night. It was, we're going to light candles in our window and stick it to those pagans until they leave Eretz Yisrael completely. And the shuk, the marketplace of Eretz Yisrael, is entirely devoid of these foreign conquerors. And then we'll feel good about ourselves again. What's the connection to Hanukkah? It's a Syrian conqueror. Palmyra is Syria. What is Hanukkah? Antiochus is a Syrian conqueror. So we'll restore an old holiday about Jewish liberation from Syrian evil overlords to impress upon current evil Syrian overlords that your days are numbered, and we're going to kick you out too. And then we'll have our victory again. Yes, so there's a national element in the resurrection of Hanukkah, not just in the original version, but in the one that was brought back.
In Eretz Yisrael.
So, now, we skipped some of the sources, but we'll have to forget about that. Now, what are the two lessons? The two lessons for the night. First one, the difference between religion in Chutz La'aretz and Eretz Yisrael. Why did I keep saying that in the diaspora it was a foregone conclusion that they would observe Hanukkah, but in Israel, no, it would go into a lull for a while until it was brought back? Answer is like this. In the diaspora, Judaism is a religion. And what is religion? It's a received set of practices that you get from your father and your grandfather. And it doesn't matter what happened 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. It's all ancient history. And what is the only thing that matters? That you preserve minhag avotenu biadenu. If my father and my grandfather lit candles on some cold, snowy evening in December, I'm going to do it too. The fact that, from a national point of view, it may seem to not make much sense anymore in light of the fact that the victory we're celebrating has been negated by a destruction, well, that's a thousand miles away. Where I am right now, Judaism is a religion. My daddy lit candles. I'm going to light candles. Whereas in Israel, what is Judaism? It's the national religion of the Jewish people. And so observances have to make sense in context. Therefore, Hanukkah dies a little bit for a good few centuries until it's brought back. What else is true? In Israel today, Tisha B'Av doesn't have the same flavor like it might have had in the days of the Vilna Gaon. Okay, why? Because you have a state of Israel. All right, and so people talk about getting rid of the 3 weeks or getting rid of Sfira. In context, observances of the past don't always make sense now. And that's the case with Hanukkah. But in the diaspora, we don't worry about that. What's another example in the Chutz La'aretz where we don't worry about the historical context or the moment, we just do whatever was done? Yom Tov Sheni Shel Gal Yot, the second day of Yom Tov. There's no reason for the second day of Yom Tov. Why do we still do it? Well, because a message was sent from Eretz Yisrael in the year 344 to observe the Minhag Avotenu Biyadenu, lest the government issue decrees and we'll forget the laws of the calendar. Okay, but the point is that, yes, we're observing second day Yom Tov because they sent that epistle, that missive from the land of Israel. But really, it's because we're just doing what our grandfathers did. They kept 2 days. So even though we don't logically need a second day, we're going to keep doing it because it's just a religion. It's not a national religion. Okay, that's very important point number one. Point number two. How does a holiday survive? A holiday or a commemoration and observance only survives if it has ritual. Okay, Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, in his famous book Zachor, written in 1982, made this point very clear, and I'll say it again, that, not that I'm a big fan of Yerushalmi, because he was a Chazer Fresser, and he was really devoid of all Judaism, but he was a great scholar. Okay, so he made the point, you have to have ceremonial, or the observance will die. In modern times, we have many 20th century Jewish holidays. The most important in my book are Yom HaShoah from the sad point of view, and Yom HaAtzmaut from or maybe even Yom Yerushalayim from a positive point of view. How do we observe those days? So when I went to Cheder as a kid, what did you have? You had a Holocaust survivor speak Yom HaShoah, and you had a blue and white cookie on Yom HaAtzmaut. Neither of those is a religious act. And the first one, the survivor speech, is time sensitive, because eventually we're all mortal and they're all going to pass on into the afterworld. So what's going to happen then? And what's going to happen when there are no more soldiers who fought in the Six-Day War to tell stories about the Shar HaRayot, okay, in Milchemet Sheshet HaYamim? When time passes without ceremonial, religious ceremonial, not just cookies, you have to wonder, will this day still be observed? And it's not just ceremonial. You can't just have some arbitrary act. It has to have spiritual significance. So the Gemara, back in source number 20, that said, well, let's abolish Hanukkah. We can't abolish it because it had a mitzvah. Proves you need ceremony. Well, let's abolish Hanukkah and the mitzvah. The response was, presume nisa. The lesson is, you need ceremony, religiously binding, but also that it has a message worth preserving and passing along the door of Ador from generation to generation. If it has that, it will have staying power. If you lack that, I wonder if it will have staying power. And with that, we'll conclude. Okay.